on top of the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, or AGMD, I'd like to welcome you all today to hear an inspiring lady with a really a story that is going to touch everybody's heart as they listen to her speak. Her name is Ann Lubenko, and it's funny how things happen in life sometimes, but Ann joined our organization and she included some information about her background, just a little bit of a blurb. She was asking for prayers, and with that, it caught our attention within the organization. And so I happened to email her back, and she was asking for prayers because she was going to be undergoing a transplant. So we began to communicate, and the more her story unfolded, the more I was truly blown away by what she has endured and how she has endured it and where she is in her life right now. During this program, I would ask that everybody just remain quiet. And then towards the end, Ann has been gracious enough to open it up to any questions that people may have on anything that she has said. If you want to communicate with her, please do not give your personal information or contact information online or during the program. If you're interested in contacting her, you can always just get in touch with our organization and we will put you in touch that way. Ann is a patient with intestinal failure, gastroparesis, neuropathic pseudobstruction, and a rare progressive form of multiple sclerosis. She's been waiting to have a multivisceral transplant, including a stomach, pancreas, small and large bowel, and kidney. And this is supposed to be scheduled at UCLA. And her inspiring story explains her faith-filled journey of overcoming numerous challenges and her desire to help others. With that, I'm going to extend the platform over to you, Ann. Welcome, and thank you so much for sharing your story and your heart with us.
Thank you so much, Mary Angela. And first, I'd like to say hello to everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are in our wonderful world. And thank you, Mary Angela, for giving me the opportunity to share my story. I really, really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure and the pleasure of the organization. I'm going to start off just asking you a question because this is what is really the basis of this whole program. How did your journey all begin?
That is a wonderful question. Well, I am 42 years old, and my journey began literally day one. I was adopted, and my mother can think back to me as an infant in diapers and having problems pooping. And asked doctors on and off, and they never had any answers, and we just kind of put it wayside. And as I started to get a little bit older, I stopped saying things to my mother about having problems going potty. But she would hear me in the bathroom struggling to go, tears. She would find blood in the underwear from hemorrhoids, things like that, from the struggle with it. Again, we asked doctors, excuse me, and no answers. You know, maybe it's the food, it was the formula when I was little. No matter what it was, they didn't have any answers to it. So I continued through my elementary, high school days. One of my big memories from high school, I was a swimmer, and I remember having my outfits and my swimsuits that were my had just gone to the bathroom outfits and swimsuits, and my outfits and my pants and my swimsuits that showed and were big enough when I hadn't gone to the bathroom for 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time and was so bloated out. Again, not much was done through the doctors. There were no answers. Continued into my young adulthood, but I suffered through that period of time with numerous bladder infections, kidney infections, late teens, early 20s, started to have kidney infections, went into kidney failure, but then things would kick back into gear and everything would be okay for the next months, years, until the next bout of infections would come. I went into the working world and was busy working and doing life, and I was in my late 20s. Went from working one day to 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, waking up with a severe Meniere's eye fever, and was completely sick. It had been well over a month that I had had a bowel movement, and my entire system was shutting down. I spent the next months in ICU. Most of it is a blur due to the high fevers. I was having hallucinations. I would come to in the hospital in ice baths, trying to reduce the fevers. They would go in, try to remove the stool, but literally could not find any other issues except for a slow bowel system and the fact that my kidneys were shutting down, my liver was shutting down, everything was going haywire. About 6-8 months into this, long road at that period of time, I finally, after battles and battles, my family with the doctors, this was the days that I had HMO. I was fortunate enough to get down to USC, and I saw a gastro doctor down there who was one of the first ones that started working with motility disorders. And he had done the infamous test called a Sidmark test, and he was thinking that it was probably along the lines of Crohn's. And during this test, they found that not only a small portion of my colon, but my entire colon was completely non-functioning. And that's what was causing me to not be able to go to the bathroom and become completely septic as everything was sitting in there for weeks and months on end. Within about a week, he had me in emergency surgery, and they bypassed of my colon. They placed ileostomy on me and kind of sent me on my way, kept a close eye on me, but sent me on my way to kind of recoup from that and start to do life. And amazingly, for the first time in a couple of years, I was actually starting to do a little bit better. The infections were at bay, and I was back to eating with the back. And if any of you have ever had ileostomies, colonoscopies, you know how much fun that those are. And it was a year later that they decided to do the ileostomy takedown with a subtotal colectomy. The subtotal colectomy turned into a full colectomy. And that was a successful surgery and, again, bought me some time. During this process, after that surgery, we found that I had small bowel overgrowth, which is the bad bacteria in the small intestine up by the stomach, which was at the same time causing GERD and all the other wonderful things that can go along with the intestinal problems that we have. After things kind of went to bay, we had struggled for about 2-3 years after that second surgery, which was in 2001. I was again back doing life. Obviously had lots of struggles with the things that I could eat and couldn't eat, but that just became life and how I dealt with my day-to-day life. And was going along. I had just gotten married. And 6 months after getting married, boom, everything started up again. And I started with these hellacious headaches that became 24/7, and they became worse and worse to the point that I had stopped working. I got to the point where I couldn't get out of bed. They were so bad, I couldn't have any light on, couldn't listen to a TV, couldn't even listen to my husband, let alone my stepkids, which was not fun for a newlywed with three adults or three teenage stepkids. That wasn't fun. And ended up back with the doctors at the time trying to figure out what was going on with the headaches, thinking that all the vomiting and the problems that were going on with my intestinal tract again was all due to the headache problems. Ended up finding out from a neurologist that I had a brain tumor. This was just before Christmas of 2009, and had emergency brain surgery January 2010. This led to the diagnosis and finding out about my MS. It is a progressive MS, not a relapsing remitting, and I do have the rare kind that gives me brain tumors that are non-cancerous, but they can turn into cancer, so we have to keep a very close eye on those. During the process with everything with the autoimmune disease of multiple sclerosis, it really re-kickstarted all my intestinal problems. The gastroparesis went into full bore and stomach became completely non-functioning along with the rest of the bowel system. So struggling back and forth months, that first year I spent more time in the hospital than I did at home, trying to figure out the diagnosis, back and forth, specialists, and it was really quite the battle, in and out, trying to find the route and the way of needing to get the care that I did need. There's a lot of doctors out there that want to do the best for people like us, but they don't have the knowledge of these crazy intestinal disorders that we have. And it was kind of like being in hell for a while, for quite a while. And I luckily today have a team around me that is amazing. I'm working with UCLA. I've also worked with Georgetown back in Washington, D.C., for those of you who are back in that area, and have gone through the pre-transplants division and have become a candidate for a multivisceral transplant. There was one point in there where I was too ill, and even though they wanted to be able to do the transplant on me, I was only weighing about 74, 75 pounds, and if they would have had the opportunity to put me on the table at that time, there would have been no way I would have made it through the surgery. So we really had to work with my TPN. I am TPN dependent. I have not eaten any type of food that has stayed down or liquid in just over 4 years as of this point. And I am eagerly awaiting for that magical phone call to hopefully give me my second chance at life. And do. So in a nutshell, there's obviously a lot more details of my story, but in a nutshell, that is kind of the A to Z in a short form.
And that is because I'm recapturing a whole, really so many years, a lifetime of this, and to cram it into the Reader's Digest version is very challenging, I know. Let me ask you, explain something about the transplant process for us.
The transplant process, wow, okay. That is quite a process. Once you come to a point, I came to a point of knowing that I had reached all the ends of my ability and exhausting all the knowledge of the doctors, the tests, the medications, everything that had been offered to me and given to me and we had tried was failing. At this point, the five hospitals in our nation that do the intestinal transplants will be willing to have you come in and start going through their rigorous testing process. During that time, they not only redo and do extensive intestinal testing, and when I'm saying intestinal, I'm meaning everything for those of us who have any of these disorders, mouth to anus testing, because it affects everything from those zones. It takes months to go through the testing process, months. and they come to a conclusion of whether or not the big item being, will it be beneficial? Have all other opportunities been exhausted? And do you have the ability to make it through the severe surgery that you would be looking to endure? For a multivisceral, with the amount of organs that they're looking at doing on me and the fact that I have MS, has never been done to date yet. So in addition to all the testing and all the groups of doctors and everything that I've met with, from neuro to psych to GI to the heart doctors, you name it, you see them. I have had to sign my life away with the unknown of what could and might happen. So there are still a lot of unknowns with intestinal transplants. If the ability to be able to do a small bowel isolized, they have done obviously quite a few more of those. Each hospital, Georgetown, UCLA, is now up to about 600, 700 small bowel or small bowel liver, small bowel kidney. Those are the majority of the ones that they do. When they start getting into the multivisceral, the numbers start to become less that they have performed. And it's also done a lot more on infants than it is done on grown adults. So it is quite a process.
And emotionally, because your whole journey has affected you, but before we get into how you have dealt with all of the emotions within this span up to the transplant, you had indicated to me that you were going to be having a transplant and we had scheduled something, and then you had to cancel it because you had to go with the potential of having the transplant. So you're on 24-hour call. Can you explain a little bit more about that and also the emotions that you were going through with that?
Yes, that's a great question, Mary Angela. I'm going to take that one little step further. When I first was back in Georgetown and was being approved for it, during the time that I was told that I was too ill, I have got to tell you, when they are telling you that you are a wonderful candidate, but you're too ill, when I walked out of that hospital, with my mom on my arm, I collapsed of my fear and of not being able to get the chance of my second life. And that gave me the fight to do whatever I could with my doctors, with my home health team, and what I could physically do, physically, mentally, to get myself a little bit stronger to be able to become active on that list, let alone what I knew what anguish and heartache being on that list can actually bring, let alone all the wonderful things and that it can bring. The day-to-day anticipation, I've been actively waiting just over 4 years now. The day-to-day anticipation can be unruly. It can be really, really hard, not just on us as the patients, but on our family and friends. Everyone seems to put their life on hold. Trying to find your transportation on how you are going to get there fast enough. The intestines last the shortest period of time out of the body, out of any organs. So us as intestinal transplant patients have to be able to get to the hospital the quickest. So the window of time is about a 6 to 8 hour window. So for me, when I was first listed back at Georgetown, and I live out in California, that became more and more unrealistic unless my family and I moved out to Georgetown, which my husband needed to stay here to be able to work. So my parents, who are almost in their 80s, were going to be my caretaker. And that became not able to happen, because what if something happened to them while we were out there? And so then I started researching and found out that UCLA also does the transplants. So I had to go through that whole process again with UCLA and them to be willing to take on this bizarre, strange case. And since I have become listed with UCLA, and they are my heroes, we have had a few calls that have come in, and I have gone rushing down. I have flown down because the call came in at the right time where I was able to go get on a flight. I drove in the middle of the night, driving 100 miles an hour, not very safe, but to get there in time to find out that the organs were too big. And the letdown, I have to tell you, is huge. After all the preparation and the anticipation to get in there and be completely prepped and be ready to be taken into this over 24-hour surgery, having no idea what the outcome is going to be, and then for them to come in and tell you that it's not a match, the letdown can be catastrophic. It can be very hard to be able to pick yourself back up again and try to do life to await that call again. That anticipation of, is it going to be right this time? And for me, it's not just how it's affecting me and my family. My heart aches for the families of the people who are losing their loved ones. And that really, I have dreams or nightmares, however people want to look at it, about the other families and the young people that are losing their life. So it's quite a roller coaster of emotions and anticipation and fear.
Yeah, exactly. I can we can only imagine that anguish that you go through each time you get a call, and then to have that disappointment, and you know, to wait 4 years for this and still endure the suffering that you're enduring physically, let alone mentally, it's beyond comprehension, I would say, unless you're going through that same thing. And how have you dealt, or how did you deal, if you're still trying to come to terms with it, not being able to eat?
Great question, and I do not always do the best with it, Mary Angela. There are days when, you know, I have to admit, I get angry and I get mad about it, and I'm cooking my favorite meals for my family, and I'll look at my husband and I say, forget it, I want to eat. And I will eat. And lo and behold, depending on the volume, it's either while I'm taking the bites or 15 minutes to an hour to 2 hours later, I am in being the porcelain goddess and not keeping any of it down. The big thing for me was trying not to do any more damage to my body, to let the TPN do what it needs to do. When we're messing with our calories, when the vomiting was so bad for me, all my electrolytes, all my blood numbers, everything was coming up so askew. And I think that was one of the reasons why I kept losing weight, even though I had my TPN at a very high caloric intake. I was still wanting to eat and drink and do what I could, but I was vomiting so many times a day that my system didn't know how to handle it. So I really had to come to it and say, what can I do to satisfy myself and the chewing aspect, which is really important for us, and to be able to give up the eating side of it. So I battle with it because there are certain days and certain things that I really do want to eat. But I also know how it makes me feel, and I know that is really, really lousy when I feel like that. And I had to look at what it was doing to me physically and mentally. So there are certain things that the doctors and I have come up with. Crackers. There are little fortune cookies are one of the things that I'm fortunate enough to be able to kind of munch on throughout the day. I'll take a little handful and eat those over a half an hour and then a couple hours later take another little handful, and I can do okay with that until the end of the day. And once the volume is enough, then I will get sick. But it gives me the ability to still be able to quote-unquote eat, to be able to chew, which releases the good endorphins for us, and satisfies me if we go out to a social event, which I'm not able to do very often, but when I do, that I don't feel that I'm completely absent from being a part of. So those are just a couple ways that I try to deal with it, but it's a struggle.
Yeah. When you do socialize, and you just tapped upon that right now, but are there events that you opt not to go to?
Yes. And a lot of those are big eating events. I feel very uncomfortable. Problems that can arise in restaurants, and I've heard this from people, you know, them wanting to charge you even though you're not eating. I've overcome a lot of that, and I've actually will pull a maitre d' or the owner or a waiter aside, and I will explain to them what is going on with me, and a lot of times then they'll accommodate that. But for me to be out in such a social setting where it's all around food specifically, that makes it really, really hard for me because I find myself moving back away from everybody. And that takes us away from a lot of social events. Because it is amazing, and all of us can see how much is related around food. So that really can make it difficult. But I do bad feedback. Sorry, I'm hearing you.
Yeah, I'm gonna mute some people and see who it is.
Okay, thank you.
So if you're muted, please don't be offended. It's just trying to get the echo off. And as you were talking, you know, it came to mind, of course, it affects you socially, and you tapped upon a little bit of the effect it has on your family and friends. But when you're having something like this, it's very difficult to keep those who you thought were close to you still close, and you find out very quickly who your true friends are.
Yes,
and
you do.
Who you don't. Can you explain a little bit about the influence of what you've gone through and how it has impacted your relationships with other people?
I sure can. Thank you for that question. That hits a lot of emotion, but I think it's one of the most key points for us as chronically ill patients. And we as humans need contact from other people. And the majority of the people in my life have gone wayside. I have old bosses who watched me go through this from the beginning of when everything kind of all hell broke loose. Back in the 90s, who are still really, really close to me. I have people who have known me for years and years and watched this, and through this last 4 years of episodes and stuff have gone wayside because they can no longer handle it. I have been accused by one of my best friends that I am anorexic and it's all in my head. And it's crushed me. It's absolutely ripped me apart and crushed me. So you do very quickly find out who are your true friends. And one of the biggest things that I had to come to terms with is whether it is one person in my life, and I'm very fortunate to have a handful of people in my life that will not waver no matter what. And they go to the doctor's appointments with me, and they fully, fully understand what is going on with me. Even a few that are out of state that have known me since we were children, and they do not waver. But all those other ones have gone wayside. And I think one of the biggest things for that, one of the biggest reasons for that is, as humans, when we see somebody, if they look okay, then we think they're doing something wrong, that it must be them, that it's not something medically. And not to use the cancer word, but that seems to be one word that people then take even if people look okay. They can relate to the cancer word. But they don't understand intestinal problems. They don't understand, you know, stomach problems. They don't understand, you know, throat problems, losing your voice, not being able to keep food down. They don't understand that. But if you, quote, unquote, look okay to them, they will assume that you're the one doing it, that it's not something medically going on. And even though it has ripped me apart, I have had to look at it, and I do better on some days than I do on other days, of that I am probably better off without them in my life because of the turmoil that they bring me and the heartache that they bring me doesn't help to give me the strength for me to get through every day that I need. I need the people that are unwavering and are there to give me the love and the support, who understand what's going on or take the time to try to understand what's going on. And they trust me, and they know that I don't have tubes coming out of my body right now because I'm anorexic. Doctors don't look at doing major surgeries on people who are anorexic. You know, and but some people just can't wrap their heads around this. And it can rip families apart because people don't understand it. For me, problems with my parents that I had growing up, it's actually brought us closer. My brother, my dear brother, who does not know how to handle anyone having a cold, he loves to try to check in and wants to be there, but he'll ask a question of how I'm doing, and he just needs to hear that I'm doing okay. Otherwise, you start giving details, he has to get off the phone. He can't handle it. But emotionally, he's there for me. So everyone has their ways of being able to handle having a sick one in their life. I mean, my husband, it's very, very hard on him. My stepkids, it's been very hard on them. They lost their mother to cancer. And now they're watching their stepmom almost lose her life. So it's been very hard on them. But in ways, they're very protective over me with it, too. So I have, you know, three wonderful kids that are on my side. Grown adults now, but, you know, kids to me that are on my side. So it's a very, very big challenge. I sometimes hesitate going out to social events where I know some of these people who have ripped my heart out, I will avoid seeing them because it hurts too much. Or I'm afraid that I might say something that I might regret.
Yeah.
So
it's amazing how the different aspects of illness can affect you in different ways and on different levels depending on
absolutely
what you're going through. But certainly it changes your whole perspective on so many things, and that just comes with the territory.
Yes.
And I know that what you go through varies from moment to moment, but just so people can have a little bit of a peek, can you describe briefly what a day in the life of Ann is like right now?
Oh, boy. Okay, a day in the life of Ann. Well, I'll give you a couple different scenarios to explain the diversity of how my days can be. And again, remember, part of this is from my multiple sclerosis. I am affected with my MS, my legs, and my feet. First thing in the morning, I can barely feel my legs, the tingling, the numbness, or the pain is so severe that it takes me a good 20, 30 minutes to try to get moving to see if I'm going to be able to be able to move. My next step from that point is whether or not my feet and my legs are going to hold me that day. There are some days I'll get up to try to go potty, and I'll just fall right to the ground, and I can't that day. Then there's other days where I can get up and I can walk, and I can actually walk without my cane and do okay. So I have my days like that. Again, upon awakening in the morning, when my TPN machine goes off, I feed for 10 hours over the night. I unhook my machine, I take care of all that stuff, and I usually start my morning off with some very light stretching and to kind of get my body moving if it is able to that day. I have my medications that I push through my line. I go through that whole rigmarole every morning, and with the headaches that I live with 24/7, that is another indication of how my day is going to rule me, whether or not I'm going to be able to be up and active, or if it's going to be more of a day in bed due to my legs or due to my headache or due to the abdominal pain that I'm enduring. If it is one of my better days, some of the things that I enjoy to do, and I know it's going to sound insane, I love to bake. I love to cook for my family. So I actually will try to do those things. I have a couple friends that are also going through some pretty big medical things, so I will try to do some meals and cook for them. I bake for a lot of my doctors and for the staff of my doctors, so I will take goodies into them. 2 to 3 days a week, I have doctor's appointments. That's every week. So that takes up a lot of my time. If on a good day, if I can get out and do any little bit of playing in my garden, that is very good for my spirit, for my emotions. I try to do that on a good day. And I have a little dog, and I spend a lot of time with her. She's kind of my little cuddle bug, and she's one of my little lights in my life, and I spend my time with her. The big key things for me on my days that I am able to do things, the things that keep me going as a person, that give me light, that give me a purpose in my life today versus how my life used to be, is I try to take care of all of our household finances. I try to do as many of the household chores, whether it's one load of laundry a day, run the dishwasher, little things like that, so I still find that I have a purpose, since so much of my life has been taken away from me. And as a type A person, that has been very, very difficult for me. So any little thing that I can find that helps to give me purpose for the day is what I will try to do. I try to reach out to my friends as much as possible. I'm very fortunate that I have wonderful neighbors. So even if it is on a so-so day, if I can make it across the street to go and talk to one of my neighbors to help give me a little light that day, then that's what I will do that day. So my days are not full of a lot. My busy days are days that I have doctor's appointments. Outside of that, it is usually a small, something simple, and then it's a rest. I usually shower every other day just because of the amount of energy that it takes out of me. I try to do my hair every 3 or 4 days because I have to take a nap after I blow dry my hair. I have kind of longish hair, thick hair, and it takes me a while to do it. And that will completely wipe me out where I actually have to take a nap after it. So each thing is a process that I know and have learned how much energy it's going to kind of zap from me. And I take it from there on what that day is going to be. I just recently, this last week, was fighting a bit of an infection, and I really didn't get much done, what I would consider much done. And those weeks can be hard, because those weeks of even not paying a bill or not being able to water my favorite plants, I feel a sense of loss. I lose the sense of my purpose. And those are the things that I really try to hold on to that help to keep me together as a person and to keep fighting through this journey. Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense. And this is probably entwined my next question with what you're speaking about. But what are three things that you've learned as a result of your medical journey?
Mm.
And I know it's hard to narrow it down to three.
It is. You know, the biggest thing for me, and I joke a lot about this, one of my coping mechanisms is being goofy and laughing a lot. If not, there can be a lot of tears. So I goof and I laugh a lot. I really try not to take myself too seriously. But I have learned that I am okay just the way I am, even though I don't always like that. That if I am doing my best, and if I can reach out to one person, even if that's just my husband or just one of my stepkids or even a dog that day, and show some love and maybe even just feed the dog that day, then my purpose in life is being fulfilled. Knowing never to give up. And that's another big struggle for those of us who go through this. For there for a while, and there can be days even now, I just wonder why. Why am I continuing to fight so hard? And then I stop, and I get frustrated with myself or mad at myself. I say, what are you thinking, Anne? You don't give up. You have too much to fight for. Keep fighting on this. Don't give up. So that if there is something to be able to do on the backside, things like what you're doing, Mary Angela, I want to be able to do what you're doing. I want to be able to give back to others. So by not giving up, by fighting through it.
I think, Anne, you automatically do that because of who you are. You're a very giving person. Your story touches people's hearts, whether they are a family or a person who is not affected by it at all and really knows nothing about it, or whether it's somebody who's going to that spot in their life, maybe not in the transplant phase, but maybe they're TPN dependent, perhaps they're trying to find a diagnosis, perhaps they're transitioning and trying to accept a diagnosis, wherever they may be. Your story and who you are and how you give sprinkles all around everybody.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Laura. I just wanted to throw something in real quick. Anne?
Yes.
What you're doing today is giving back is a bigger purpose than you could ever know.
Thank you.
I work with Mary Angela too, because I'm the same way. I have to give back because I need a purpose in life. And what you're doing helps so many people you don't even know.
Thank you very much.
Because everybody
really,
that's listened
really
to you
that.
Will pass on your wonderful attitude to somebody else that needs a little help.
Thank you. God bless
thank
you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you. And Mary Angela, one more thing on that medical journey. I know, yeah. I got emotional there. I apologize. Again, probably the most important thing for us is if you don't get an answer from a doctor that you are satisfied with or that you feel is going to help you, don't ever be afraid to go to another doctor. Don't ever be afraid to go get a second opinion. This is our fight, our individual fights. And with seeing doctors and having thousands and thousands of tests and been to hundreds of doctors and doing it, is to never allow someone to tell us that it's in our heads or something like that. Never give up on trying to find the answers. And I think that's really getting to your point, Marianne, so what you're saying. You know, one of the main things with my medical journey is to know is it doesn't matter if you have to cross across country, like I did to go to D.C. to try to find the doctors who had the skills and knowledge to be able to help me.
Beautifully put. Is there anything else that you just want to add in either explaining something that has happened to you or advice that you can give others in the way you've endured through your faith, through your attitude, and through the support of those who are close to you as well as your sense of purpose? Anything that you'd just like to add before we open it up to more questions?
You betcha. There's, you know, a couple of things quickly that can kind of go with coping as far as my faith. There's a few things that I try to do that get me out of self. I think that really helped me with coping. I play word games on my iPad, on my phone, with my mother, with friends. And my husband really notices that that's the time he can see I kind of check out of everything else and I'm really focusing on my games. You know, my silly little mind games, but it takes me out of the reality of what life, you know, is going on. That really helps my mental state. And, you know, these are the things, the mental state and our physical state. The physical state when I can do something around the house or work in my garden, maintain the finances, you know, do something like that. That's giving me my reason. Being goofy, laughing at myself helps me to keep my positive attitude. My faith goes up and down depending on how things are going. And I really work on keeping my faith because that's what's going to keep me going. And whether that our faith is believing in a higher power, a doorknob, whatever it is that we believe in, that's what's going to help keep us going every day. And that's been my big thing through the ups and downs, the times when you're laying in a hospital bed for me and looking out the window and doing the why me, and turning that around to get out of that self-mind for myself. To pull back that faith to help give me the strength to make it through that next 24 hours, which I know is going to be a battle. those are the big things that I try to focus on. And allowing myself to have a good cry, you know, or to turn around and just be an absolute complete goofball and just be silly and let it out and have a hysterical laugh. And I got to say, sometimes this is absolutely wonderful. Sometimes it's just wonderful. So I don't know.
Ian, with your permission, is it okay if I open it up to questions?
Absolutely. Would be great.
Before you ask your question, just give your first name, or you can make up a first name if you've got a desire to be particular name, and if you want to ask a question and you're having trouble getting in, you can just call out my name, Mary Angela. I am going to unmute some people that I have muted, but if I hear the feedback, I may have to unmute you, so hopefully this is going to work. Give me 1 minute. Perfect. Does anybody have a question that they would like to ask Ian? No, she was so good at explaining it.
I do. This is Bethany. Hi.
Hi, Bethany.
Hi. Your story, it made me actually cry when I was listening to it. And it's such an amazing, you're such an amazing person. And I can kind of relate to some of what you're going through. I'm in I'm in the middle of the country, and I'm having a hard time finding doctors who know what to do with me, and I'm in a pre-intestinal transplant program. And I was just wondering, would you highly recommend UCLA then as a place to go?
Hi, Bethany. It's so nice to hear you. Thank you for what you said. I really appreciate it. You know, UCLA is my safe haven. I'm not sure exactly where you are. Georgetown, which is, you know, I'm not sure which is closer for you. There is a fabulous intestinal hospital in Texas. I know that they were doing pediatric only, but I can look into that. Actually, a girlfriend that I went to high school with, I just found out that her husband is one of the intestinal transplant surgeons there. So I can actually find that out for you, Bethany. What state are you in, hon?
Okay. I'm in Kansas City, Missouri.
You're in Kansas,
right?
Okay.
Now the closest place is Nebraska, but they really are doing just infant, you know, or toddler transplant.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that it is just UCLA and Georgetown that is doing the adult, but that should be widening, should be becoming more and more. I don't think that they realized that as many of us adults have survived as long as we have with these incredible intestinal diseases that we have. To them, they thought that most of us had died off. What my transplant surgeons have told me. We don't know how you guys have survived this.
I've heard that too from my doctors.
Yeah. So it is a battle. And if, you know, go through Mary Angela and, you know, get my email address, or she can get mine, and then we can, because I'd love to be able to help you with that, hon.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
You're welcome. But don't give up with it. And I know it's a chore, and good for you for starting the process, but it's going to take a lot of your time, and it's very emotional.
Yeah.
Please try to stick with it. In the long run, it will pay off.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. You take care. God bless you, hon.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
Hi, this is Laura. Can you hear me?
Hi, Laura.
Yes, hey, Laura.
Hi.
Yep.
This is actually kind of a little bit for Bethany there, too. I'm not as bad off. I don't need a transplant yet. However, the hospital that, it's a shame, you live in Kansas City, Missouri, and the one of the best doctors ever to do motility used to practice at KU Med in Kansas.
I know who you're talking about. It's Dr.
Which I went and saw him.
Yeah.
Dr.
McCallum. And I do know, now that he's up in Texas, I spoke to him about a year ago, because he's such a good doctor, even though it was 13 years ago that I did his FDA trial for the Medtronic pacer. I still can call him and his people, and they will talk to me and give me any advice. He is doing those, because he told me to come out there.
Oh,
he told me to go
right
out there. El Paso, Texas. He's he runs the university hospital, I guess it's called, the whole gastro part
of that. University, yep.
Yeah.
I wonder,
what was his name, Laura?
Do gastroparesis?
Richard McCollum.
Richard, thank you.
And yeah,
he's one of our advisors. He's one of our advisors since the inception of our organization in 1991. Mm. And he is a remarkable physician as well as so compassionate. He's just an outstanding individual.
And knows what he's doing.
Yes. So if you need contact information, I can certainly provide that as well. And Laura has had that personal connection with him as a patient. We've had him as an advisor, and he's spoken at so many of our symposiums that we've had. So I know him on the professional basis as well as other phases, with the exception of being a patient.
That's
Texas
great.
Is a little too far for somebody who can't travel. So, yeah. Any other questions? No. Laura.
Yeah?
Has spoken about Dr. McCallum and her fight with trying to get the gastric pacer. She spoke about that a little, and I'm sure she shares some of that emotion of being up and down with things. And you talked about your faith, and I think one of the things that so many patients get so frustrated with and really, really struggle on a daily basis is trying to get that definitive diagnosis after perhaps being misdiagnosed in so many ways.
Times.
And going to doctors and being disappointed that they're either putting you in that hold of it's all in your head, it's stress, or, you know, it's something else we don't know, or we don't know what to do with you. And then finally, after a very lengthy time and you're losing ground on your own health, trying to get that help in that doctor and taking all the energy that you have, how do you endure that, and what advice can you give to patients? I know you spoke about it a little bit, but can you just expand upon that? Because I think there are just so many patients that I've spoken with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it is gut-wrenching, no pun intended, you know, to go through it, to be hitting your head against a brick wall over and over and over and over again, where I remember down at Cedars-Sinai, one of the first doctors, Dr. Lynn, that was doing the small bowel overgrowth. And again, I walked out of the room, and my mother and I collapsed down to the floor in tears of joy, of going, oh, my God, this is the first person who actually understands me, who believes me, who gets me.
I'm with you there.
But the battle of, you know, we put so much trust and faith into doctors. And to not lose that, to continue that belief that they can help us, which they can, but to not allow ourselves to be completely deflated when there are doctors who don't know. It is okay for people to not know, but we have to continue fighting to look for those who do know. Today, we are so fortunate to have programs like this one that we're on, to have all the ability of the internet, to be able to find resources. Don't always believe everything you read, because otherwise we'll all be dying tomorrow. But there's so many resources out there, to be able to use those. But I think the number one is talking to people who have been through it, who have the similarities. Now, similarities can also lead us down wrong paths, because my similarity might be a little bit different than Bethany's or than Laura's or than Mary Angela's, that we each need a slightly different specific doctor. But by asking those questions and getting to some of these, I hate to use the word top doctors, but the doctors who know our situations are going to know the other doctor who knows the similar but different diagnosis. And through those resources, we're going to have a better chance of finding our answers. It's in the process of it, of not allowing ourselves to get our heads in the sand, which I've done many a times, and wanted to say, forget everything and everybody. I give up. We can't give up. We've got to keep fighting to be able to find those people who know, or if not, be the gift to the doctor and to the other people, patients out there, to be the guinea pigs for them to find out some answers that can help us and help others down the road. And that, to me, has been one of my biggest things, is being that gift. I have signed my life away to UCLA and to Georgetown of saying, if I don't make it through this transplant, take my body apart finding answers. Because that's got to be the reason why. So it's, you know, if we can be a gift of someone being a guinea pig to find out new answers. And what all of us are going through is such uncharted territories, which seems amazing and seems weird. But intestinal disease is going in directions that is unheard of. And no one knows why. But it is happening, and it's affecting so many people these days that if we can stick together as groups and create these resources like Mary Angela, you know, has done, to be able to stick together and help those resources come to light is going to help the next person that's coming down this path behind us.
This is Laura again. Something I just recently noticed over many of my hospital visits, that you are absolutely right. There are so many doctors that really have no clue.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they're a GI doctor, they may know to send you to somebody. And I've always been one to fight with everybody I know. If the doctor doesn't help you or give you the answer, you're paying him. Go somewhere else. You know, it's just like a fast food place. They don't give you the right food, you go somewhere else.
That's right.
And
yeah,
it's not worth the battle
of fighting with them. It's just
right
to move on.
No.
But I have found now that a lot of times when a lot of hospitals are changing over to hospitalists as far as the doctors that work in the hospital, as opposed to having your doctor come in and do rounds every day, a lot of them, some of the bigger ones, like where I live
right.
in Massachusetts, do that because there's so many patients.
Yeah, I have a lot
but
of
I have found
with that, too.
That a lot of the younger specialists, because they're teaching it now in school, in medical
yes.
school,
yes.
are better than a lot of the other doctors.
Correct.
And I do know one...
It's a newer knowledge.
Right. And I do know one little piece of why this has gone a little more rampant and people don't know quite what happened, only because it's part of my life. I've been a type 1 diabetic since I was 10. I'm going to be 46 this year. And when I became a diabetic, you know, we joked about it, but not really, that I would never see 40. Because at that time, the treatment for diabetes and everything was not as good as it is now.
Right.
The problem is they started making better treatment for diabetics. Diabetics are all living longer. And now that we're living longer, we're the biggest group of, for gastroparesis, basic one, you know, not all of them, but like
mm-hmm.
the gastroparesis, you know, any the nerve just paralyzation of stuff. It's kind of a side effect of diabetes, like neuropathy in your hands. I am been lucky, I guess. I got all my neuropathy on my inside. So I still have good hands and feet, but the bottom inside doesn't work very well. But they said it's because we're living so much longer, all of a sudden now we're all getting it because
right.
we hadn't lived that long before for them to see it.
Right.
And it's just, you know, which is in a way, it's a good thing and kind of a bad thing, but it's a really good thing that medicine has come that far and, you know, not thinking I was going to make it to 40. And if things didn't change at all, I can hang on to the gastroparesis part, I, you know, certainly plan on another 20 good years. And if things get better, even more than that. I have,
we
you know, my kidneys,
you
everything are great. But, you know, you have to...
I think one of the other challenges that patients go through is when they do find somebody who is expert, the initial time to make an appointment can be endless, especially when you're suffering greatly. Because a lot of the top
yes.
doctors in the field, and look how many people have GI problems, let alone a motility problem that is impacting the aspect of your life. And Ian, can you speak to that point?
Yes, and that's a great point with that. One suggestion, and again, not all doctors will do this, and not all doctors know the next doctor. One of the best things that I have had done for me is some of these doctors that I have seen who didn't know but knew of people who knew more than they did, they actually called the doctor specifically, not the doctor's office, not to talk to the front office, the doctor specifically, and said, I need you to see her within the next few days. So we kind of bypassed some of that red tape. But that can't always happen. I've been fortunate in some of those situations, and then there's been times when I've waited months and then I've ended up in the hospital, you know, between and almost on my deathbed. And then you finally get in to see them. Sometimes there's absolutely nothing we can do about it. We have to wait. But if you have a doctor that you feel comfortable with, maybe suggesting to them, hey, I'm having a difficult time getting, you know, an appointment with this. Is there any way that you can help me with this? Some doctors might be willing to help you with that. Some might not. Just one suggestion there. If not, you can always ask to be put on a cancellation list. That can always work as well. But that can be very, very tough when we are told to sit and wait all the time, and they don't understand, especially a lot of the front office staff. They don't know what we're going through and the fear, the fear of it. So that's a tough one. I wish I had some better answers on that one.
In closing, because we're really out of time, can you just close your part of the program and just give some sort of hope and last words within the session to those who can certainly relate on many levels to what you're going through?
I think the hope that's been given here today is the hope that you guys have given me. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much. Thank you guys for taking the time to listen to my story. Every single one of us are important. We are meant to be here. There are answers out there for us. And we are due those answers. And I hope and pray that all of us have the strength to continue fighting to get those answers. Please don't give up. Please know that you're not alone in any of this, that there are those of us who don't even know you, who love you, who care about you, and will help fight with you. And I just, my heart goes out to each and every one of you. I wish all of you nothing but the best, for good strength, for the wisdom to continue, for peace of mind, and for happiness in your life. And again, just thank you for giving me the gift to be able to share my time with you guys.
I'm telling you, Ian, you exemplify why you have this program here today, and all of you remember Ann Ravenko, because you're going to be seeing her name more and more within the organization, and we'll be giving updates too, or she'll be giving updates on the process when she finally does get that transplant. On that note, I just want to say thank you to everybody who participated in this program, joined us. I know that you are taking something back with you, because that's how Ann operates. When she talks, it automatically influences other people. Ann, you do, and you keep on hearing me say this, you have such an inspiring spirit. And your words and your spirit generate that strong faith and that compassion and that strength and determination in a heart that touches everybody. And it's such a privilege for you to have shared a piece of your story with us, heart, soul, and mind. And we look forward to hearing more. It truly is a privilege, and I thank you.
Thank you.
I hope all of you have a day as good as you can have, but hopefully you'll have some more hope and positive thoughts based on Andrew. Thank you all, and God bless you all.